Revelation chapter 12 is a rather chilling chapter because it makes us uncomfortable because there's this malevolent power at work in our world. Evil stalks, and we see it when we look around. Wicked people so often have the upper hand. There's unreasonable vindictiveness, abuse of power, belittling and disdaining fundamental truths, and it's hard to take. That's how David felt about 3,000 years ago. King David, he's writing in Psalm 11, and there are malicious, hate-filled arrows being targeted at the upright. And he cries out, it disturbs him. These people are firing from the shadows. They're attacking God's people. And with heartfelt anguish, he says, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? How can we cope? So there's a great deal of unprovoked animosity in Revelation chapter 12. But there's also, more encouragingly, there's also unparalleled triumph in these verses. Who conquers? Not diabolical heinousness, but ultimate good. Encourages us, doesn't it? For the Christian, this chapter is wonderfully heartwarming. There's a great, verse 10, there's this great shout of praise in heaven. Unrestrained rejoicing, verse 12. The voice of victory drowns out every evil cry. But we mustn't miss the elephant in the room, or rather the dragon. Because what thought struck you as you read about the great red dragon in verse 3? Three words kept popping into my mind. I wasn't quite sure where they came from. Some subconscious thought, no doubt, lurking somewhere below the surface. I had to look up these three words that so seemed to sum up this evil dragon. And the three words were, I guess someone here might be able to tell me where they're from, but I had to look it up. Is that hideous strength? Those are the words that kept coming into my mind. That hideous strength. This is a hideous creature. And hideous is a very graphic word. Those are the sort of words I like. Strong word. So I thought, well, is the word hideous anywhere in the Bible? The English version. I don't know what you think, but I had a quick search. The only two versions I could find that used that word hideous were the Common English Bible and the Message. And both of those only used it in one particular chapter. That's chapter 7 of Daniel, describing that fourth terrible beast. And it's hideous. We studied it not that long ago. But if you read Pilgrim's Progress, you may remember that about a third of the way through, Christian suddenly finds his way barred by a monster. And how does John Bunyan describe this monster? As hideous. Hideous to behold. He had wings like a dragon, feet like a bear, and out of his belly came fire and smoke, and his mouth was as the mouth of a lion. And John Bunyan doesn't hold back in that allegory. And he describes this terrible fight, this conflict that ensues. It's a fight to the death. There's Christian against the dragon. And he goes on to say, he says, no man can imagine, unless he has seen and heard as I did, what yelling and hideous roaring was made by the monster all the time of the fight. So that hideous strength, diabolical power, was turned on Christian in John Bunyan's allegory. But against overwhelming odds, Christian survived. Now, how was that possible? Wonder what you think. How could an ordinary person, an ordinary Christian like us this evening, how can we survive such an onslaught? Well, we'll come back to that later. But what about those words, that hideous strength? Well, they're the title of a novel by C.S. Lewis. And he's actually making a reference back to an earlier poem. And this poem is describing the Tower of Babel. And you can imagine the Tower of Babel built. It was on a plain somewhere, wasn't it? And the sun setting. And this hideous strength. The line of the poem says, the shadow of that hideous strength 6 miles and more it is of length. So I want us to think for a moment about the Tower of Babel. What was behind, or who was behind, we should say, the tower, and what was his purpose? Well, it's clearly Satan provoking the people, because he determined to unite all of mankind in rebellion against their maker. This is a global rejection of God, an attempt to overthrow God-given authority, God's rightful position. They wanted to attack that and destroy that. And they're all at it. It's outright warfare. And Satan is behind it all, driving them forward. He's the deceiver of the whole world. That's in verse 9. So Satan wants humanity ruined. It's nothing less than the kingdom of man displacing and excluding the kingdom of God. So this isn't a minor point. One of the commentators makes the very significant comment and says, if God hadn't checked that rebellion, those people would have pursued this course further and further and further to their own downfall. So God's action in halting that rebellion at the time of the Tower of Babel was an act of mercy. God prevented mankind from self-destruction. And that's just an example. I want us to think of various other examples of Satan's determination to ruin everything for us. Because throughout history, it's happened over and over again, hasn't it? This warfare, the forces of evil and the forces of good in Almighty God. God is being attacked relentlessly, persistently. Satan must be on the go all the time, not just at Babel, when else? Many examples. For example, the Egyptian persecution at the time of Moses. Satan was there, wasn't he? He wanted to kill, destroy the offspring, the male offspring. Then there's the idolatry at the golden calf. Shortly after, Satan's there. The attacks on King David. Queen Athaliah, she determined to wipe out the whole Davidic dynasty, the whole line. And then there's Haman. We've been thinking about him recently. Haman's determination to destroy all the Jews. Now, Satan's always there. Why is he there? Why is this wave after wave, attack after attack? Why is he so determined? Well, it all goes back, doesn't it, to Genesis 3, verse 15. Wonderful promise. The offspring of the woman, Jesus Christ, the offspring of the woman, descendant of Abraham, from the family of David, is going to crush Satan's head. So that's why he's attacking God's people all the time. That's why he wants to destroy the Davidic line. Because he knows that from that line, the Savior is coming, the one who will crush his head. So he must stamp that out. And Satan will do anything to prevent it. He's always there, always pursuing that evil course. Right through the Old Testament, on into the New Testament. What does Satan do in the New Testament? First thing, maybe, was Herod's massacre of the infants. Try to get Jesus killed at the very beginning. Then there's Jesus' temptations in the wilderness, trying to get to divert Jesus from his course. Or Peter's rebuke. Remember, Peter says, "You'll never suffer and die." And Jesus has to say, "Get behind me, Satan." And ultimately, of course, it was the cross that was engineered by Satan, but only to bring about his downfall. So Satan's always there. That's what that verse 4 is all about. The dragon wants to devour the child. Satan must eliminate Jesus because Jesus was destined to destroy him. So what are we told? What do you know about this dragon? I've entitled this message, "Our Hideous Foe." And that hideous strength is all too apparent. So don't underestimate this satanic beast. But then, as we were commenting earlier, he's very much a defeated enemy. So there's a great deal to encourage us in this chapter. But let's focus, first of all, on the enemy, Satan. And every word in this chapter adds to the awfulness of this monstrous being. He's a great red dragon. What does great suggest? It's great in size. The word is literally mega. He's a mega dragon. You just have to look at what its tail can do. It sweeps out a third of the stars. Well, that's an awesome display of power, isn't it? Whatever else that might mean. And he's red. Why is the dragon red? Well, it indicates violent oppression. There's a link with a few chapters later, Revelation 17, verse 3. Remember the woman sitting on the scarlet beast, wearing scarlet? And what's she doing? She's drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So the dragon is red for a purpose. It's to convey his malevolence, his merciless affliction, his bloodthirsty oppression of God's people. How many martyrs have there been? How much believing blood has been shed down the centuries? Satan's there. He's that great red dragon. He's red. And notice the number of heads. 7 heads and 10 horns. And 7 and 10 are numbers suggesting completeness. This is total evil. And it's quite interesting to go back to Daniel chapter 7. We were studying that. And there was 4 beasts, wasn't there? And the third beast had 4 heads. So how many heads have we got? We've got 3 beasts with 1 head and 1 beast with 4 heads. So we've got 7 heads. And how many horns did they have altogether? Well, the last beast initially had 10 horns. So what we have here, I'm sure, a deliberate forcing us to think, this is not just one beast, this is an amalgamation of all those 4 terrible beasts. This is ultimate evil to be found in this terrible beast. And a horn, what's a horn suggesting? A horn is a symbol of strength. The dragon has 10 of them. And 7 heads means, it would seem, he was virtually indestructible. And he's wearing those crowns, those diadems, exercising usurped authority. It's not true authority. It's not legitimate crowns. But nevertheless, there is something there, fearsome and fearful. He's wearing the crowns. And what's he doing? Well, he's waiting. We were saying he's waiting, ready to devour, to destroy, to obliterate Jesus the moment he's born, effectively, or even before he was born, wasn't it? His plan was always there to strike, to take out and eliminate Jesus Christ, the one who was born to crush him. So who's the woman? There's a woman there. And we might think it's Mary, the mother of Jesus. But I'm sure it's much more than Mary, because Satan pours out his rage on all God's faithful people, the faithful people, the community of godly people at the time when Jesus was born, but also all of us. We're under attack. Satan is attacking us in the wilderness. So all God's children are nourished. Verse 6, we're told we're nourished in the wilderness. So I want us for a moment now to turn from Satan, the devil, and look at the woman. How's she described in verse 1? And this is something to really encourage us. She's clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Now, what do you make of that? Well, it's beyond incredible, because that's heaven's perspective on us, God's people. That's what God thinks about his people. We're clothed with the sun, the moon under our feet. The clue there, perhaps, is the head, the crown of 12 stars. What's the significance of the 12 stars? Well, it refers to the 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament, the 12 apostles in the New Testament. It's a picture of the whole church combined. And it's almost overwhelming. Imagine being clothed with the sun. How awesome is that? Lenski puts it like this, and he says, to have the sun as a robe, the moon as a footstool, and stars as a crown means to appear in heavenly splendor. So I reckon many people look at us this evening, we're not that many, we're quite a few, I suppose, but compared to those outside, there's a few of us, and yet God sees us in this remarkable description. And I love the way that Lenski puts it. He throws in this little comment afterwards. He says, the lovely moon being good enough only for her feet. That's amazing, isn't it? That's how we are described. And whatever the world may think about us, This is God's perspective. This should encourage us and stir us up and spur us on. And it's a wonderful picture. But then the other picture, we've got Satan about to pounce. So he's ready. He's right there. He wants to get his jaws onto the child Jesus, the one who will rule all nations with the rod of iron. So it's a picture of Christ and his birth. And there's this dragon. He's right there wanting to gulp up the offspring of the woman, to nullify that promise. Genesis 3, verse 15. He wants to get Christ destroyed before anything can happen. And will he succeed? Well, verse 5. The child, more literally, the child was snatched up to God and to his throne. And that's a wonderful picture, because it's almost like he's getting his teeth into the child, and only the child snatched away, Jesus, because Satan did get his teeth into Christ. Christ died. So there was that partial victory. But then, of course, it was followed by the resurrection. But much more than the resurrection, because it says, what does it say? And to the throne. He's caught up to God and to his throne. This is enthronement. So state that Jesus is snatched away. Satan can't succeed. He gets his fangs in. He's trying to take a bite. It seems that all's lost, but he's snatched away. There's victory, resurrection. Death is dead. Love has won. Christ has conquered. We almost sung that. Wonderful, isn't it? So it's beyond incredible. Heaven triumphs. Jesus is enthroned. Victory eternally established. So is that the conclusion? Our great foe is defeated. The future is permanently established. We win. But Satan's not yet finished. He's still alive. So we focus on the triumph, but we've also remembered that he's our hideous foe. So what's Satan going to do? What can we expect? Has he got an attack plan? Because we need to know. We need to be ready. Verse 9. What's Satan called? That ancient serpent. So immediately we're back to the Garden of Eden. How did the serpent get the better of Eve? He deceives her. He says, you won't surely die. And it's a lie to trick her. And he's making out, he says, eat the fruit, he says. God's trying to restrict you, to keep you down. He says, your eyes will be opened. You'll see amazing things. You're missing out. Your experiences are limited. God's restricting you. You can't fully trust him. That's Satan's terrible deceit, total deception, because God was everything that Adam and Eve needed, and they should trust him absolutely. But they're tricked. The Satan's cunning. He deceives Eve with the cataclysmic consequences we see all around. He's the deceiver of the whole world. I love those verses, 2 Thessalonians 2:10. I was trying to explain a little bit at lunchtime to the girls about, there's this verse in Thessalonians that it talks about Satan's deceptive activity. And it says, that verse says, they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. And I was trying to think back to when I was a boy. You know, I always had to eat the horrible vegetables, okay? But they would be good for you, you see? So you have to do some horrible things. And maybe every morning I had to have porridge. Oh, because I was brought up in Scotland. And I absolutely hated this porridge, but I gulped it down. I covered it in sugar, gulped it down as fast as I could, and hopefully it did some good somewhere. But here it is. If it says you've got to love an error and be saved, well, you might think, well, okay, I'll hold my nose, I'll go through it because I want to be saved. But it says love the truth and so be saved. And so we're embracing truth, we're being saved. What could be more wonderful? And yet people, it goes on that verse to say that people are turning their backs on that. Why would anyone not want to love the truth and so be saved? Doesn't make sense, does it? Well, it was because Satan's deceiving people. He's tricking them. They're being turned away, poisoning their minds. Makes out sin's no big deal. Especially, I think, young people. The great temptation is to think, well, I can rein back in when I get a bit older. You know, I'll have a good time now. And Satan tricks us. Oh, it's no big deal. You know, do this or that or the other. You can rein it back in later, but it doesn't happen, does it, so often? And there's so many lies. You know, like, I was trying to think of a few lies. I'll just mention one. One lie that he says is that if you knock someone else down, it somehow elevates you. Well, that's just nonsense, isn't it? So many of these ridiculous things. Or revenge is sweet. Well, it's not sweet at all. I was trying to think of biblical examples. There's so many. It's very easy to think of biblical examples involving covetousness or greed. I think that must be one of the main problems we have. Love of money, the root of all kinds of evil. But here's some other ones. Lust. That was Amnon's downfall, do you remember? He couldn't stop obsessing about his half-sister Tamar. He had to violate her at all costs. And it was Satan driving him to do that, no doubt, taking advantage of his lust. And Haman, well, we keep thinking about him. What was his problem? Pride, racial hatred. He just could not abide the Jew Mordecai, who wouldn't bow down to him. So he planned his death, but also a complete Jewish genocide. Judas, well, there's one who loved money. Satan entered him, and he agreed to betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. They're all deceived. What happened? Did Amnon's lust bring any lasting satisfaction? It's amazing what it says in 2 Samuel 13. It says, afterwards, he got his wicked way, but he hated her afterwards with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he'd loved her. He didn't get any benefit from it. And then he's murdered by Tamar's brother Amnon. So there's no benefit. Satan's not encourages him to do it, but he then stabs him in the back. Haman, he has to destroy Mordecai to gratify his burning hatred and his pride. It's all consuming. He thinks he can get away with it, but does he? Spoiler alert, I don't know if we've got that far yet. But he doesn't. And in fact, he loses his life on the very gallows he prepared to use against Mordecai. There's Judas. Now, I sometimes think, well, there he is. He's so desperate for that 30 pieces of silver. How much of it does he spend? Not one penny. Doesn't bring him happiness. That's what people think. I've got this friend every week, at least once a week, he tells me he wants to win the lottery. And he's thinking he might win it this week. And he's hoping to win 100 million or something. And he's going to pay my mortgage off. So I thought, well, okay, I could do that. But I think it's ridiculous. It's not going to make him happy, is it? If he wins 100 million, what are you going to do? And he certainly didn't give any pleasure to Judas and so many others. But Satan's behind all these things. But that's part one of his plan. So part one of his plan is he deceives, he tricks, he lures people in to sin. Now, that's a terrible thing he does, but that's just phase one, because this is his masterstroke. What does he do next? He then accuses them, doesn't he? Remember, as a boy at primary school, I lived in Scotland, as I said, and one break time, it was very sad, I had a very sad life. I was all on my own, my parents were off in Africa, and I used to just stand around in the playground. I don't know if I had any friends. But I can't have had any friends that day because a group of older boys grabbed me and dragged me outside the school gates. I still remember this many years later. Okay, so it's a bit traumatic for a little lad being dragged out by a group of the older boys. And then they guarded the gates. I couldn't get back in. And I think afterwards I realised they wanted me to climb over the wall. I don't think I was up to that. But anyway, they went off to get somebody else, I suspect. And so I just sneaked back in. I thought that was the end of it. Until later on the break, they grabbed me and dragged me to the headmaster's study to be belted. That's what we had. Children need to know what happened in those days. Belted for breaking the school rule, climbing over the wall. Well, fortunately, I could explain that I didn't climb over the wall and the headmaster didn't belt me on that particular occasion. This is what Satan does, but on a far grander scale. He sort of lures people into some sort of sin, and then, as soon as they've sinned, he turns on them. And he drags them before God and accuses them. So that's why he's called the accuser of our brothers, verse 10, who accuses them day and night. And he knows his theology, doesn't he? He knows that God, who's loving and kind and merciful and gracious, he's also just and righteous and holy. He can't just excuse sin. So he goes to God and he quotes verses like, "The soul who sins shall die. The wages of sin is death." And the wonderful picture we have is Zechariah chapter 3, isn't it? Where you've got Joshua, the high priest. He's dressed in filthy rags And he's standing in God's presence. He's a total failure. And who else is there? Satan, the accuser. And he's doing what he loves to do. He's accusing God's people. He's accusing that man. And what happens? Well, it's surprising because Satan would seem to have the upper hand because Joshua, there he is, he's muddied with sin. He's stained, he's besmirched, he's an abject failure. But then the amazing thing was, it's not the end. You'd think that Satan had the upper hand, but God takes his sin away and takes away the filthy garments and replaces them with new, clean, spotless, pure garments. And it's a wonderful good news for Joshua, but also it's wonderful good news for us, isn't it? Because that's the problem, is that Satan's accusations have no more effect. The mocking voice, his mocking voice against the believers is deadened through Jesus. And that's what we have in verse 7. So that's where we're getting to. So Satan, first of all, he deceives, then he accuses, but now verse 7, there's this war in heaven. There's a decisive battle. And I think it's when Jesus says in Luke 10:18, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. I think it's the same thing. Because Satan's no longer able to accuse in heaven. Why not? He can't accuse the high priest or any of us at all, because Jesus has conquered. It talks in that passage about Michael being victorious. But though Michael and his angels are fighting, the ultimate victory was on the cross, wasn't it? When Jesus said, it is finished. The victory was won. Jesus died in the place of sinners. So he died my death. He paid the penalty. The just one was substituted for unjust ones. The one who knew no sin was made sin. He stood condemned in my place. And so you see at the moment, what's happened? In one stroke, Satan's ruined because he's lost all his leverage. He can't accuse now in any real sense because we can be forgiven. Jesus died. And he still tries to accuse, and we still need to keep going back and reminding ourselves that we have been forgiven. A debt is paid. I love some of these hymns to think about when you feel under attack. That one we sing quite often, when Satan tempts me to despair and tells me of the guilt within, upward I look and see him there. That's Jesus, who made an end of all my sin. And one I don't think we sing, no, not despairingly come I to thee. No, not distrustingly bend I the knee. Sin hath gone over me, yet is this still my plea? Jesus has died. We've got that plea, haven't we? We don't need to despair. What though the accuser roar of ills that I have done? This is the amazing thing. I know them well, and thousands more. Jehovah findeth none. And that takes us back to the great battle in Pilgrim's Progress. Do you remember? How does Christian get the victory over that terrible dragon attacking in the beast with the fire and everything? Well, it's kind of a bit, I know there's various films about Pilgrim's Progress, but I bet it's a bit of an anticlimax in a sense, because Satan is there, he's accusing Christian of thousands of things. You did this and that, and you didn't do something else. And how does Christian get the victory? He just says, well, in the hymn we'd say, I am the guilty one, yet I go free. And he says it's true. These are exact words from the book. He says, all this is true and much more, because Jesus has paid the price. I've done all these things, but I'm forgiven. There's mercy through Christ, because he cried out, it's finished on the cross. Well, let's draw to a conclusion. One, there's a third thing that Satan does, very briefly. So he lures us into sin, then he accuses, but that's lost its power now. But what does he do? I was thinking of Ahithophel. Do you remember him? David's counsellor. And he was advising, he turned against David, King David, and started advising Absalom, giving him all this fantastic advice. Okay? But Absalom doesn't do it. And so what does Ahithophel do? He realised that his amazing advice is being rejected. So immediately he puts his house in order and kills himself. Okay? A bit tragic. But it's a lot better than what Satan does. What does Satan do? Satan, he knows he's defeated. Jesus conquered on the cross. But what does Satan do? It says, verse 17, the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. So he doesn't just give up. He doesn't go away. Instead, he becomes more furious. He pursues and persecutes. He's defeated, but he remains a hideous foe. How many Christians, the persecution of Christians seems to be ramped up in recent days. He's on the go. He's furious. He's trying to destroy and hits out. So how do you feel as a Christian? How does it make you feel that Satan is after you? He's spewing out his rage. Does that discourage you? Well, I'd say it's an encouragement because he's lost the battle. He can't have your soul. All he can do now is take your body. And he hits out. And also remember that we're fighting. Who are we fighting? We're not fighting against flesh and blood. We're not fighting a human foe. If you're fighting somebody, I don't know, I was fighting Adam or something, then I'm sure he'd beat me. But if I did beat him, it would be no great achievement because we're just flesh and blood like that. But we're fighting spiritual forces in the heavenly realms. And the little guy beats the big guy. The big guy who's determined, who hates you, is furious and mad. And that's the wonderful thing, isn't it? That as Christians, we're more than conquerors. And it's not just on this level, it's on the cosmic level. So, you know, we should be encouraged that we can. And one last encouragement, the last few things. Verses 6 and 14 talks about being nourished in the wilderness. God cares for his children. He feeds us and shepherds us. And it makes you think back. The wilderness makes us think back to escape from Egypt. And what happened? They were fed and nourished with manna. God's bread from heaven. And what's manna a picture of? Jesus. I am the living bread that came down from heaven, Jesus says. So that's how we're nourished. We're nourished by Jesus. He's everything. Is he everything to each one of us? We're coming round the Lord's table. It's a wonderful way to come in, isn't it? Because we're finishing with Jesus. And we're finishing with Jesus, the bread of life, the manna. We're nourished by him. And we're nourished at the table. And whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me and I in him. And we're to be overwhelmed. We're to be filled. This is one of my favourite little expressions in the Bible. Filled with all the fullness of God. Does that mean something to you? As these humble, human, frail beings, we can be filled with all the fullness of God. Jonathan Edwards, he said this was his great longing. He said to be full of Christ alone. That's our goal, isn't it? Jesus. And he'll bring us through the wilderness. He'll give us himself. He'll nourish us and strengthen us. And we're just about to sing, 'Tis Jesus, the first and the last. I want to end with Jesus. Jesus is everything. The first and the last, everything in between. 'Tis Jesus, the first and the last, whose spirit shall guide us safe home. We'll praise him for all his past and trust him for all that's to come. So we've got this enemy, but he's a defeated enemy. And what do we have? Jesus, who nourishes us and feeds us and blesses us and brings us through the wilderness. And the little guy beats the big guy by God's help.